I think he will no doubt continue to describe dark and dramatic worlds that are thrilling to inhabit and revisit, and I hope you all give a warm welcome to Stephen Graham Jones.
This story I'm going to read here is my one stab I've ever given at writing nonfiction, and I think it falls apart as nonfiction. It may fall apart as a story, too. I don't know. It's called Bestiary. I grew up in a land shaped by animals. The first bird I shot in a buffalo wallow. There would be countless more. Owls and ducks flying away with my pellet gun pellets lodged in them. Doves I wouldn't learn to clean and eat for years. The blood on my yellow breast like a dab of jelly on butter toast. Quail that were beautiful and pliant in my hand. Scissor tails that fell in looping arcs, their tails disappointing up close. Mounds of red and white and black woodpeckers my grandmother would point out for me that, even with their bodies full of birdshot, still needed to be chased down in the tall grass. Once, on accident, a mockingbird that wanted to put me in jail, take away my gun. The hole I dug to hide it in was deep. There would be more. A mole bat, just to see if I could. A compact little hawk of a kind I've never seen again. I buried it too, then took 3 steps away, found a pair of rattlesnakes mating, and watched them until they saw me and tried to break apart. Couldn't. Hours later, skinless, headless, no guts, they still rose from the pan of grease I was cooking them in, struck at me with their blunt necks. Another time I walked onto a pair of sand rattlers. Never knew how purple and pink their belly skin was until they were dead. The same year, a normal rattler pulled at my pants leg but couldn't get through. I killed it for so long that the venom got in my arm, swelled it from wrist to elbow. Days after that, just to see if it was a thing I could do, or to see if it was something I shouldn't do, maybe, I got down on my knees before a rattler and we stared at each other for half an hour until it started striking and I started trying to tap it on the head with my ball peen hammer. I buried it in a deep, deep hole with an owl I killed that same day. Then, to keep them there, I bent into a 55-gallon drum, drove it down around the owl and the snake until it was level with the ground, told myself it was over, now, me, them, that I was sorry and it was over. I was wrong. Later that year, I would stand in the brake lights of a pickup truck and help beat rabbits' heads against the bumper, because they weren't dead enough yet, then throw them into a pile already spilling over the bed rails. Because it was summer, we couldn't eat the rabbits, had to throw them into a pit for the coyotes. Later, in the snow, with slide-action rifles that felt so much like the air pumps on my belly guns, I would run down elk and mule deer and whitetail from the dancing beds of trucks, shoot prairie dogs beside my gun, and look through my scope one afternoon at what should have been a cow moose 30 yards out, broadside, but instead stood into a cinnamon grizzly for 2 cubs tumbling into view. That time, my uncle guided the barrel of my gun down for me and kept it there. And I looked over the top of my scope at the mother bear and wondered where my uncle had been 3 years ago in my buffalo wallow. When, out of birds but not daylight, I'd aimed for too long straight up into a power line and hit it. Then felt a small slug immediately in the ground by my left foot instead of the bones of my face. I dug the slug out. It was shaped like a mushroom, still hugging the power line, and I did any of a thousand things with it. I suppose, not in the right. I wrote a part two to that about all the dogs I've had, which have been many, many dogs. And it was too sad. I couldn't actually hit print on that one. This is my other one attempt. Well, this isn't really this. I meant this is a story, but nevertheless. Well, anyways, here it is. This is coming out. No, it just came out in a place called Controlled Burn. The wages, an argument. Thesis. At 12 years old, he was at the lake, Colorado, playing hide and seek or war or something with his brother. Lots of running through the bushes, getting farther and farther away from the truck. His brother, who was 3 years younger than him. The shape of the part of the lake they were at was like a finger reaching into land, and all the green things grew right up to the water. He was 12 years old. He wasn't thinking anything. He was thinking maybe about his little brother, the way their hair was the same, dark and shining and fine. It would make a ring in the sun to stay level, even when his head moved, his eyes always looking somewhere else. They were running in the trees now. He was ahead of his brother, but not by much, but enough that for a moment, when he stumbled out into the tall grass and sunlight, he was alone, blinking, and he could hear them coming right out of the pages of National Geographic, manifesting first his heads balanced on long necks, and then his things driven by men on horseback, llamas. And for as long as he stood there with them streaming by, he could believe anything. Antithesis. At 14 years old, he was sitting at the breakfast table waiting for his pants to warm in the dryer. It was exactly 8 days after his dad walked down to the bar and shot himself in the cab of his truck. At school, no one talked to him. He could do whatever he wanted. He stared into his locker. His pants were tumbling 4 feet away, the only thing in this morning. His mother walked past him, past the dryer, to the porch with the first cup of coffee, then returned, waited for him to finish his cereal in a way that he knew that's just what she was doing. When he was done, she told him their kitten had a kitten of her own, evidently. Just one. It was on the porch. She told him twice that she couldn't do it. He nodded okay. On the porch, the kitten was still breathing. No hair, no eyes. His mom went from the gun through the screen door, but he couldn't because it would spook the horses and he had to get to school. So he picked the kitten up with the flat bottom shovel and carried it to the burn burrows, where there was a small concrete pad. It was cold. His breath hung white in front of his face. Because he was wearing basketball shorts and boots without socks, the kitten, when he slammed the cinder block down, was wet on his legs and warm, and he didn't tell any of them about it. Synthesis. At 26 years old, he was sleeping in a clean bed with his wife. He slept with his toe on her heel, the same trick he used with his brothers when he was young, to make sure they were there. His brothers were all in different states now. He had stayed within 100 miles of home. He walked silently a little after 2 a.m., and he lay there breathing until almost 4, telling himself to breathe. When his wife asked him, was he okay, he told her yes the first 2 times. But then on the 3rd, he didn't answer. And she sat up and didn't ask her if he'd ever killed anyone one drunk night with a trash can lid. But he did tell her that he had that memory, all smeared around in his head, of placing that person with a face in plastic under the kitchen floor of a rent house. His wife told him that she was with him all the time back then, that that never could have happened, that drinking, he wouldn't have planned ahead enough to take care of everything, that there would have been a smell, something. But then too, she said that the only reason this seemed so real to him was that this is what he does as a writer. Then it was his job to anticipate all the details, all the excuses, anything that might expose the lie. And her voice coming at him across the darkness of the bed was the same as the llamas rushing past, only now they were going the other way. Man, I totally forgot that is that kitten story. My ringtone here is Def Leppard, so y'all couldn't hear it. Good job. Okay. It's a good song. There's not many bad ones. Yeah, let's do some. I'm gonna try to read something where maybe an animal doesn't die. Yeah, I read this one. I think I know Morris has read this one. He could be the only one. I don't know. Animals unknown. The goose that laid the golden retriever never got caught, because who would expect a retriever, a dog bred to collect waterfowl, to mount one of the birds he'd been trained to deliver. But two, we all understand, I think, are all dogs. I mean, for years you held their long, delicate necks in your mouth, know the weight of their bodies, how it feels when their muscles undulate from tail to beak, but are warned never to taste. Then one day, though, splashing through the shallows, no gun behind you, one of those birds turns around, presents herself. And what gets you excited isn't the imitation under her tail feathers there, but the memory of her neck under your teeth, the way her body can quiver in death. And then when it's done, she's shy about it, bringing the way geese will, her head ducking down to the base of her left wing again and again, you with your nose to the ground, like you got a scent there. And for the first time ever, your bird spreads her wings to cut the air and lifts off into the sky, your seed swirling inside her, soon to be wrapped in delicate eggshell, the shame inside it golden like you. Like that afternoon, and safe, because she knows better than ever warm that egg back up, except in memory. Here's a pretty random piece. It's maybe 75 words. I think this is a lie. I don't know. Appetite. Hold on, my uncle said, when I was about to tell him that that was the hamburger stand I was talking about. Hold on, so we could hear the toll-free number at the end of the ad on the radio. It was for male itching. I looked down at the two fingers of his right hand he had in my sternum, keeping me there, quiet, my back against the passenger seat. When the ad was over, he let his foot off the accelerator and hooked his chin ahead of us to the hamburger stand I'd been talking about all day. Said, that one? And I shook my head back and forth just once. No, maybe we should just keep on looking. Here's one that animals don't die, but things die. The cavalry doctor, the therapist I find in the Yellow Pages tells me both that I'm overweight, the obvious why I'm there in his office in the first place, and that overweight people, while not quite schizophrenic, seem nevertheless to be touched by it, as since they're unable to accept that the person who sits down at this big meal is the same person who's been wearing the veil around the middle, they must in some essential way be two people. At which point he makes a standard joke about his amazing weight loss stories and the associated visuals, the pants two people could fit into if they wanted. But that's anecdotal, not really support for his schizophrenia argument. What is that later, when I'm field dressing him on his mahogany desk, both of us medicated, him with anesthetic for plot drawer, me with appetite, is that he's still trying to make his point. Explain to me how his offhand observation about two people in one body was my trigger, my psychotic break. That his words essentially gave me license to feed his word, my other gluttonous self, and that I should understand that none of this is my fault, but his, an elaborate suicide, obesity kills, ha ha. And I smile, pull a string of meat from between his ribs, hold it up to the bare bowl of his lamp to check for marbling, and ask him who's the associate man. I like reading short pieces. Well, I like reading all kinds of pieces. This is, I call this one Antenna, and I don't know what you don't call it an epigraph. You can put a city under the title. I don't know what you call it, but this is Lubbock, Texas, April 1999, in italics, which makes it special. Antenna. What the four cowboys to jump out of and pick up a Thursday afternoon to teach me a lesson about music and blue hair and tattoos and chains and shaved eyebrows and earrings and cheek piercings and tongue studs. Pieces of metal pushed through my lip, my nostril, my nipples, my navel, my scrotum. What those four cowboys with their beer and their truck and their hats and their boots and their steel guitar and their dip and their horsehair belts and their matching shirts and their high school fucking memories don't know is that each time they rise up for me, their gloved fist held high like their daddy's taught them without teaching them, like they're reaching in the sky for something to bring down on me, upon me. What they don't know is that each time they bring their fist down, all they're doing is driving all that metal deeper into me. I wrote that for one of my students. He was absent for a couple of days, and he had blue hair, and he showed back up, and his face was just black and blue, and I asked what happened, and he said, Lubbock, you know? You know, there's dogs and cats in this story, too. Maybe that's all I'm not right. I didn't do that on purpose. I didn't bring animal stories for y'all on purpose. This is a story that showed up in Literal Latte a while back. The complete absence of cats is another definition for silence. The tornado of my 14th year did many things. It placed Mrs. Zimmer's station wagon in Kim Stanley's lawn upside down, the antenna planted up to the base. It carefully took out each window on the east side of 12th, even the stained glass of the church. It lifted every dry good in the grocery store and then held them up for 9 impossible seconds, the metal shelving sighing a relief known only to Randy Wall, locked out of the stockroom by the older bag boys. Not an egg was broken. It worked the red striped straw into the sticky black granite telephone ball in front of the bank. Until the straw rotted, it was a novelty to pretend you were drinking from it. Let the warmth of the flashbulb, the fact that you were alive, wash over you. All but two of the seniors that year had their graduation pictures taken there. The other two had their diplomas handed over to their mothers. There was no eye contact. There was nothing to say. That was all one said. Right then, it was still the wig store in the sky, and a clean, unlikely path around the junkyard, and the Luther's Great Dane riding across town in a cushion of air, Mrs. Zimmer with her face pressed to the headliner of her station wagon, her husband's bare legs approaching from the front door of Kim Stanley's house, his lunch hour. He tried to explain. It was an act of God. There wasn't a cat anywhere in the world. All the bare mannequin heads from the waste store were never recovered either. You can still find them in ditches with grass growing across their plastic scalps, and in chimneys, their eyes black and knowing, and falling from the sky, their lips composed, cheeks drawn in, about to smile. Rudolph the Great Dane watching them, waiting for them, his great tail fanning the grass slowly. He doesn't remember the Luger at all, is an Allen dog now, with the straw. Pictures of it are on display in the courthouse, pictures of all of it, really, except me, and the lit cigarette and tornado it wedged between my fingers, and my father touching down directly across from me, his hair still airborne. We stared at each other as the stained glass fell in slivers all around us, and I held the smoke in deep, deep, and then he said it. I'll pretend I didn't see that, and turned around, started peeking through the rubble of what's left of our house, our town, our lives. Behind him, I smiled, took one long last drag, and then aimed it back out at the heavens, and thanks. I read the last story from Miss Lynn and me, Discovering America. This story, I don't sound less like fiction, or this story is all true too, I think, except for the part where somebody dies, I guess. Discovering America. Because I'm Indian in Tallahassee, Florida, the girl behind the counter feels compelled to pull a leather strap around her neck, show me her medicine pouch, how authentic it is. Yeah, I say, They don't tell her about the one-act play I'm writing by this Indian in the gift shop at the bottom of Carlsbad Caverns. His name isn't Curio, but that's what the lady calls him when she sighs into line with her Germanic accent and her Carl May childhood. You should do a rain dance or something, she tells him. She's never seen heat like this, like New Mexico. In the play, she's sweating, he's sweating, there's uncounted tons of rock above them, all this pressure. In Tallahassee, it rained all the time. I stayed there for 11 months, 19 days, and 6 hours. Because I'm Indian at a party in Little Rock, Arkansas, a group of students approaches me out of the back room of a house, the ceremony still thick on their breath. In a shy voice, their leader asks me what kind of animal my spirit helper is, and when I can't quite get enough tact into my mouth to answer, they make a show of respect. Say they understand if I can't tell them, really. They tell me theirs, though. A grasshopper, a dragonfly, 3 wolves. And somewhere in there, I become that tall, silent Indian in Thomas Pynchon's Mortality and Mercy in Vienna, right before he goes cannibalistic in the middle of an otherwise happening party. The working title of the play I'm still writing is that time that Indian started killing everybody. Standing there with my beer, I don't revise it. In Little Rock, there were all kinds of bugs I hadn't seen before. I stayed there for 5 months, 4 days, and 22 hours. Because I'm Indian in Odessa, Texas, the guy picks me up on the side of the road, asks me what kind. He's a welfare worker. His dashboard is black with it. When I say Blackfeet, he finishes for me with Montana. Says, yeah, you drove up there for a while. Cold as hell. Yeah, I say, he was going to be on that ride. He drives and tells me how when he was up there, he used to ride a helicopter to the rig every morning. It was that cold. And Trey, I tell him I'm a National Guard at the airlift hay and supplies a couple of winters back. He nods as if it's all coming back to him, and then, with both arms draped over the wheel, real casual, asks me if they still run over Indians up there. I turn to him and he explains the sport, even hangs a tire in the ditch to show me how it's done. In Odessa, the butane guns go all night, and it's hard to sleep. I stayed there for 3 months, 14 days, and 14 hours. Because I'm Indian, the guys at the warehouse in Globes, New Mexico, I had a single feather of the happy face that's been carved in the back of my locker ever since I got there. It's not like looking in a mirror. Every time, it's not like looking in a mirror. My second week there, we're sweeping rat droppings into huge piles. And when I lean over one to see what Butch is pointing at, he slams his broom down, drives it all into my face. That weekend, I start copying it all up, because I'm sure it's the hantavirus that's been killing Indians all over. My whole check goes into the payphone, calling everyone, talking to them one last time, reading them my play, the part where Custer kills one of the gift shop people the old way, which means he hits them across the face with a log of Copenhagen, then follows them down to finish it, out of mercy. In Clovis, they don't turn your trucks off so you can talk on the phone, so you have to scream. I stayed there for 4 weeks, 1 day, and 2.5 hours. Because I'm Indian in Carlsbad, New Mexico, the crew I'm working with calls me chief, mushes me over every time there's another animal track in the dirt. I don't know what to learn about the tracks, even though I do. For a couple of hours, we work in silence, up one row, down another. Once I find strange, cartoonish tracks in my row, traced with the sharp corner of a hoe. But I pretend to miss them, pretend no one's watching me miss them. All this pretending. Towards the end of the day, I pass one of the crew, and without looking up, he asks about scouting by today, chief. I'm blunt away from his row, look up for the briefest moment, long enough to say it. Nobody you know. He doesn't laugh, neither do I. And later that night in the gas station, I finish the play I started writing in Florida. It starts when the clerk wipes the sweat from his forehead, says how damn hot it is, and dry. I neither nod nor don't nod, just wait for him to say it. In Carlsbad, New Mexico, the law is sluggish, slow to respond. I stay there for 16 hours, 9 minutes, and 52 seconds. When the rain comes, it's not because I danced it up, but because I brought it with me. Make sure I'm doing it right on time. This story, I always have to check this story. I was doing a reading somewhere once, and I got to the last page of this one, and it was gone. I was just stranded up here, and I couldn't pick it up. And so I just went to another story, which was no replacement, you know. And I'm reading the other story, having a good old time, and all of a sudden, here's the last page of this last story. And it's all because, I don't know if y'all have been taught this, but when you do readings, one of the first things I was ever taught was use paper clips. Don't use staples, because it's a hassle to have to fold over, make all that racket. But the bad thing about using paper clips is you lose pages. Screen time. Oh, this is my VH1 pop-up video story, too. Y'all remember that? Pop-up video? It's not still around, is it? Everything I find when I'm talking to people, I'm trying to be smart while at dinner and places. And I realize all the history I know is pretty much from VH1. Maybe that's what everybody else is, too, though. Although Bill had to explain to me a lot this whole northeastern geography, the New England geography, like where the states are in relation to each other. It's strange to me. How you can like go from here to New York in 4 hours and to Washington, D.C. in 3. It's so amazing just being close to things, you know. In West Texas, you're not close to anything. You're maybe the sky, you know. And it's really strange to me. Screen time. We had all seen the yellow and black vans lining the town, sit outside the drugstore for about 10 minutes, and drive B straight out to the old drive-in, but it was Cheryl who found the ad in the paper, misplaced under legal notices. Wanted, she read, laid across the hood of my truck, a kissing boy. I smiled when she talked to me today. Lynn at the drugstore said the van people were from the movies, but they'd rent the old drive-in for $750 a day, still needed directions. Does he look like a kissing boy? Cheryl asked Lynn, framing my face with her hands. And Lynn said I sure looked like something. I stole a pack of dusty rubbers off the wall while Lynn looked away politely. And then the cowbell was a brass ringing thing, and we were gone, leaving in my truck off into our last summer, trying to redo everything one last time before whatever was coming came. We were just out of high school, and hadn't learned yet about how hard you had to watch not to let 10 years get behind you. The next morning, I was one of four who showed up at the drive-in to be a kissing boy, and the only one who had is Cheryl to pick my button-up shirt, tuck it in right, and wash under my fingernails with a toothbrush and bleach. Of the three others, two were Tim and Jim, twin linebackers from 6 years back. I had been playing touch football during sixth grade recess, my helmet overbalancing me, making me faster than I was. They were still drunk from the night before, leaning on each other and blinking their eyes too fast. One night, my freshman year, they stuffed me in a plastic trash can, sat on the lid, smoking dope, and waving at people who drove by. The other of the three was old Chester from the gas station, who didn't even make it on the tarp before he ran his finger down the hall line and took four girls back and was asked to leave. I felt like John Schneider for some reason. When I looked back the last time before stepping in, Cheryl was posing like a poster, her legs crossed with the shins, her lace-up boots skylined out the driver's side window of my truck. She was posing on purpose to make me keep all my promises. We practiced from an audition deep into the night. Still though, when I walked under the tarp, I wasn't ready for Charlie, with her hair too light and dull to be natural, her eyes green like she was from another world altogether. She was sitting to the right of a little man who turned out to be her uncle, who was introduced as their director. She was smoking a cigarette fast and angry and bouncing the ashes straight up, farting with gravity. Later that year, I would find in a catalog all the bit parts she played and have the tape shipped to me COD. In one of the music videos, she would dance around for a few seconds in a white bra and flared out a skirt. For discipline, I would only let myself watch that part after watching all the other four videos, including the one we shot that week at the old drive-in. A place my dad always said held special significance for me in my beginnings, if I knew what he meant. I watched them without sound because somehow that made it last longer. That first day under the tarp, we didn't test run Kiss either. Me and Charlie, I did get in a fight though with Tim and Jim. After Tim kneeled in front of Charlie, took her hand and held it to his unshaved cheek. He started singing some slow, faint song to her, and she just smiled with her mouth and ash behind the table. Air director rested his chin on the back of his linked fingers, hands bent at the wrist, elbows close to his ribs, and watched. He had laryngitis or something, and I never heard his voice, just followed his white tip baton on the leak, meaning I didn't get the job, but that was in a few minutes. Right then, what was happening was Jim covered his hand with his mouth and elbowed me soft inside, so I noticed the fool his brother was making himself for her. When he touched me the second time, I came back with his shoulder pushing him away, and when his big hand caressed the back of my neck like he was my father or something, I was already punching when we were on the ground and hearing the sharp stalk white leads rolling. Tim kicking both of us and finally diving in too. By the time the poor girl separated us, her bikini top was most of the way pulled off, and Tim and Jim were laughing, elbowing me inside again. That fight with them was one of the last things I meant to redo anyways, even if nobody won, or if they said they did, it didn't matter. The first thing Charlie asked me was was I local. I nodded. The second thing was did I think I was a knight in shining armor or something. I shrugged and signed on for $70 a day. I was probably standing in the exact same spot where my dad had hooked my mom's bra 18 years ago, told her not to worry, everything's going to be alright. Some blue and white love scene breaking the screen for all time. That night I had a handful of cash too. Sure, I'll ask when my lips tired. She used the flat side of her voice, and I told her it was her idea after all, not a job. So then, what are you going to buy me, she asked. I told her anything, because it was 8 o'clock and all the stores were closed. We were going to eat at the Texaco anyway, just like every night when we did. When we didn't want to get tired of her parents and mine. I did buy her a huge candy wedding ring though, and stained her mouth blue and there looked like a little girl. Nothing but Charlie. Parked out at the end of the old airstrip with our friends in the beer I bought, we played Bob Seger on my tape deck and let our headlights fill up and describe. I didn't know what song the video was going to be yet, but I knew it was going to be Bob Seger. One of the band drivers had told me that much earlier when we were both packed into the old projection booth, bringing up the camera that they brought. My job was to keep the spiders off him. We were both sweating and drinking lemonade with more than 5 cups. We couldn't settle down. That Charlie girl, he said, whistling in without noise, and I nodded and looked away from the spiderweb bridge caught between his hair and above the ceiling. Outside our booth, the parking lot was filled with people. With all the car club cars, the air director positioned neatly between the speakers with the baton, then repositioned. The clipboard girl showed me the car I would be performing in, third row back. It was a long, long bala with rally rims, and me and Charlie were going to be in the back seat, the second base crowd, no lines to remember, only motions to follow. Just pretend she's your girlfriend, she said. And that night when the headlights were off and no planes were coming, I closed my eyes to Cheryl's blue candy mouth and drove us into San Angelo, where we rented a motel room for the first time in our 5 years together. Cheryl rang her sister's house once to let her know she was safe. We ate at a Chinese restaurant with chopsticks, a sharp under the table with my knife, skewering the chicken and pork and feeding each other like lovers. I never meant to marry her. It was all make-believe. The next morning they cut my hair, because I didn't look like I was from 62. The hair guy asked me, was I a token local, and I didn't answer him. Charlie watched as he cut and finally just took over, holding the comb under teeth, touching sometimes on his shoulder or a knee. Bob's coming tomorrow, she said, then followed with Bob Seger, you know? I smiled and told her I knew. The haircut took longer than most because I kept moving every other hand. Finally she had cut my ears and given me a flat top. Punishment, she called it, and it reminded me to come. My wet hair was all around us. She told me I looked like I should be in an extra in a movie about mall shots, and then led me by the hand to our umbrella. She opened the passenger door and bent over, looking in. Behind us, one of the van drivers clapped the whistle. She shook her head and lit a cigarette. We can't smoke in the car, you know. Leather seats, rolls. I told her I didn't smoke much anyway, and then I stood there with nothing to say. My white skin sideburns and back of the neck burning wonderfully in the sun. Later that night, another $70 in hand, she all rubbed lotion into my small burns as I drove and said she missed my hair. That night in San Angelo, it was custom ordered pizza at some dark place we'd been to for prom. When the waiter wasn't around, I looked away and told Cheryl I liked my hair better like this. It was easier. That night, one more of the dusty road to the hotel room, and one more night, I opened my eyes and said, don't worry. When Rick gets old enough, I plan on drinking hard one night, and then lied to him that he was conceived out of the old drive-in, and I listened to him fall out. Bob Seger's mouth moving with no noise, his guitar deep by the sound of thunder. I'll never ask his mom about it. 2 days later, Cheryl was on the set with me, holding my arm with both her hands. I was already calling the set, not the old drive-in. She made fun of me, asked what was I going to do when the video was over. I shrugged, stood by the Impala, talked to the bearded accountant leaning under his hood. He said I was lucky. This car was a home run car if there ever was one. He offered his beer and we sat in the shade of a van in the rain and talked about where the rest of our class had wound up after graduation, where we might have wound up ourselves. She was already saying we too. We both were. I didn't notice. Instead, I was watching the helicopter of Bob Seger approach a day late. They had to set it down a half mile off to keep the dust off the cars. A yellow VW van picked him up and rode back. And when he stepped out, he was a star, and Cheryl was squeezing the roof into my arm, and I was even getting a warmth in my throat. And the floorboard of my truck were all the old A-tracks multiple and empty sign, even though his A-track players were dead. The rest of the day we spent doing dry runs, Bob Seger straddling the hood of some car, pool table felt glued to the bottom of his boots, me and Charlie sitting in the back seat stage kissing. The clipboard girl telling me what to do with my right arm, since that's mostly what we've seen when the windows were fogged. A lot of the time I was alone in the car too, since Charlie was the backseat girl in four other cars in different rows. Once a blonde girl poked her head in my backseat and said, oops, walked him out, and then was gone. When I finally shot the video, it would take 2 nights. Cheryl would be sitting out at the road in my truck, parking lights on, waiting for life to begin. We'd spend the days between the nights at her sister's empty house, and her sister was nice enough to bring once before coming home from work. I never got Bob Seger's autograph either. I did talk to him, though, the day after the shoot, when everybody was gone, when he came back in his hometown with a small video camera, to stand in the old drive-in and look around and find me sitting in the third row. I told him I was the kissing boy, and he smiled and said, are we home? The other day, Rick asked me why I liked that old video so much. I told him it was a good song, but had the volume turned all the way down, too. He shook his head and left on his bicycle to wherever 9-year-olds go in the summer heat. Cheryl was in the kitchen on my own, trying to organize the class reunion, trying to get everybody together one more time. I was pushing play, rewind, no discipline at all. Remembering that second night of shooting, when the fire trucks were there to make the rain, when the camera crane hovered impossibly over our Impala, and Charlie climbed on top of me and let me kiss her hard and deep. She was out of breath from running from the first 3 cars, and her shirt was wet. In the front seat, the battery-driven humidifier was turned into 10, and the windows were impenetrable. And somewhere on the yellow van was playing Bob Seger at full tilt, and Bob Seger himself was leaning back into the fans, singing, his voice getting pulled behind him to lose itself on the driving screen, where there were spliced together love scenes in blue, all turning into each other. In the video, my right arm curves around Charlie Wayne's lower back, pulls her close, and her two black hair is falling over both of us, her hands on his shoulder, both pushing away and not letting go, blinking and listening. I think I got time for one more. Yeah, just one short one. Let's see. I bring way too much stuff to these things. Would y'all rather hear a zombie story or a masturbation story? Y'all have a choice. Y'all have a preference? Is Pennsylvania known for one or the other? Zombie? Alright, see if I'm pretty sure I'm watching.
Stephen, this is the state of the Night of the Living Dead where the movie was made.
We're all talking.
I'll find this thing here. I'm making something for a masturbation story. Someday I'll be good and write a zombie masturbation story. Let's see. kind of a Santa Claus massacre story. I thought it was poetry at first. It was printed on scratch paper, but I don't write poetry, so it's really. Give me a second here. I'm really trying to find the zombie story. This can only mean that I left on a plane for somebody else to read. Okay, so y'all get the masturbation story. you know what happens in the zombie story anyways, you know, there's a dead guy marching around and somebody has to kill him. If it was a zombie novel, there'd be lots of dead zombies, but the short story is only time for one zombie. Fabergé, this just came out from the Third Coast, I guess. This will be my last story. For tonight, anyways, I'll write a lot more stories after this. Fabergé. And then there was a day, the week, the year my mother found the magazine I had hidden in such a perfect place, shuffled in with the rest of my magazines. And I don't think she even told me at first, but thought about it for a week, maybe two. Looked at herself in the mirror a little too long some mornings, was too polite to me about staring into the refrigerator for minutes on end. And she never told my dad either, but that was just because he was dead already, so maybe he knew anyway, in a way dead people know things, which makes their skulls into glass. So he already noticed my theory of masturbation, that when a woman dies, no matter how old she is, how married, how religious, instead of her life flashing before her eyes, she gets snapshots of every boy or man who's ever thought about her alone with lubrication. And how this means that some women, they just die forever, and are maybe happy, maybe sick, or maybe they don't care. And my dad, from the cockpit of the plane, he's still trying to pull out of that nosedive. He knows this about me, and I know that this is what I think. And not if he wrecks, but when he wrecks, like he's been doing since I was 12, and it happened 3 years ago. He'll know about the theory of masturbation and smile behind the mic he should be screaming into, because one corollary of my theory is that he's not really dying here. That, when his wife, my mom, finally dies, he'll live again, and not just for an instant, but for all those years he was just watching her across the cafeteria. And I'm there too with my tray, giving this to him all I can, Dad. And it makes it easier for me when my mom finally confronts me about the pornography in her house, how she doesn't understand boys, won't even pretend to. And the magazine is there in her hands somehow, rumbled to hide the cover, the same way I had to run after I bought it, because the store and the parking lot of the street were also suddenly full of staring people. And then she does the thing I'm not expecting, opens it, not to the centerfold, the obvious material, but to the full-page girl back before the classifieds, standing there naked from head to foot. And I guess my mom knows this girl is my girl, because of the way the stapled spine is worn, or because the page is dog-eared, or I don't care how, but she knows. And we look at each other, and I can tell that she's proud of me in the littlest possible bit. Because this may be the only girl in the magazine who their eyes are touching, the only one looking at the camera instead of through it, like the photographer wants. And then, no words, she gives it back to me, says she doesn't want to find it again. And I can't even say anything like I usually do. Anything like, don't worry, you won't, or then maybe you'll come in my room. Instead of any of that, I roll the magazine back up, slunk up to my room, and don't even open it for 2 days, as long as I've gone since I bought it. But then what I finally do is with the window open, the lotion in the bathroom, and I could be reading anything. Not looking at her, but too, she's the only place left anymore. And it's not about the underswell of her breast or the flare of her hips, the skin stretched tight across her pelvic bones. It was never about any of that. But about the prop she's holding for some reason, a small single-inch plane, its nose turned down into a dive, I know, through its cockpit window, a man pulling back on the yoke, a magazine open on the single side of another naked woman holding another tiny plane, and on, furious, infinitesimal, until I have to close my eyes to see the rest. Thank you.
Opportunity. If you'd like to ask Stephen questions, I'm sure he'd be gracious enough to answer.
About dogs or kittens or something?
Can you give me questions?
Yeah.
Is there any particular reason why I'm going to like the animals a lot and like killing?
Yeah. Maybe I'm. Sometimes.
Sometimes I think I do that because I'm not a subtle enough writer, but I have to do big things like splatter rabbits across the screen. Also, when I look back at the stories I wrote when I very first started writing, when Bill was first teaching me to write, there's always an animal that gets it in the end, you know? And it's just, I guess it's because growing up on a farm, the animals were always the ones that got it, you know? Like, I remember we were having a barbecue once, and I had this big old black dog named Pepper. He was a real good dog, and we were all standing around eating burgers, talking, and my dog Pepper growled at one of the other dogs, telling him to stay away from a dropped chip or something. And my nephew, my uncle's son, was standing over there kind of by them, and my uncle he said, no dog's going to growl at my son, and he took like 3 steps back and reached into his car and got his gun and just blew the dog away right in the middle of all of us. I think that imprinted me. So.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I had lots of other bad animal experiences, but I don't want to really leave it here.
Anything else?
Yes.
So, do you kill small animals all the time as a kid or something?
No. No, I watch He-Man, and then I kill someone. Like that kid's story. Like, at that time, when I was 14, I was the official man of the house. There was no dad around, so when a little embryonic kid gets born and needs to be killed, I'm the only one who can do it, you know? I guess I did kill a lot of animals growing up. I remember the big rush for me when I was 14. I think when I was 14, was I got to go outside and warm the truck up when it was cold. You know, that would have been thrilling for me to turn ignition and feel like I was driving or something. And I went out there one day to do that, and I pulled the door closed and it wouldn't close. And so then I tried 20 more times to close it, and then I finally looked down, and sure enough, one of my neighbor's kids had crawled up into the door, and they were all in a bad situation. You know? And it had to be beat against the wall to kill it. And then I had to go to school that day and act like everything was normal, which it wasn't that abnormal. But I didn't do it like out of meanness or serial killer practice or anything. It was just animals. I just had a puppy die. I was really sad about that. So I'm getting better, and I was really sad. I mean, usually when they die, I'm just like, another one. I was sad this time. But no, I remember when I was 12, I was hanging out with a friend, and we'd catch horny toads in 5-gallon buckets. We'd fill up the 3/4 full of horny toads, and at the bottom 6 inches would just be dead and suffocated. We didn't do it on purpose, but we just went off horny toads moral. My friend had brought out this stuff, all of this one horny toad's orifices with firecrackers. And I felt really bad about that, and that turned me off to killing animals a whole lot. I didn't actually light it, but I didn't stop him either, so I feel guilty for that. But I mean, and I remember in Bleeding to Me somewhere, there's a character who says you don't learn not to kill things by not killing things. I think I wouldn't know not to kill small animals. But I mean, that's one of those things, if you extend it, it really falls apart. Anything else?
Just a more general question. What's the writing process like for a short story? How long does it sit in your head? And once you get it down initially, how long does it take you to get it right?
That screen time story I wrote with Bob Seger in it, that was a 45-minute story. I wrote it, I watched 2 episodes of VH1, and I went upstairs and hammered it out. And then it showed up in a textbook, and the person in the textbook wanted me to write a little paragraph about my writing process. And I wrote her back, and I said, well, I just told you, 45 minutes after lunch. And we went back and forth for about 2 months until she finally got me to say, yes, I rewrote it. But I just had a story come out in another textbook. I haven't seen it yet, but the person who did it told me about it, and he said, and in that part they also want me to write a little kind of essay thing about the process of writing. And
And so I wrote, you know, I write a novel in 4 weeks, and then I revise for 2 weeks, and I'm done. And he said all of your days had to change. He changed them all to a year and a half to write a novel. So I look like a slacker when you read that book, you know. As for how long will the story stay in my head before I write it, there's some stories, like say that kitten story, and I guess I'm bringing it back to animals the next day, but you just dwell on things in your life, and they're always in your head, and so everything kind of filters through them. But I have found that when I have a story and idea, the idea is only good if it comes with a voice, and if it does come with a voice, then you have, then I at least have to write it down and write it down all at once. No matter where I'm supposed to be. Like, people get stranded at the airport by me all the time because I'm not writing, you know. But I think I'd rather get some words down on the page than have somebody be happy with me. And as for the longest it ever took me to write a short story was once I worked on a story for 2 weeks, and that was like a marathon, you know. I get a bandana on my head and I was sweating and everything. It was really rough. And it turned out good, I think. It was a decent story, but I don't know if it worked 2 weeks. I have no idea. I did that 72-hour novel contest once, and that was nothing but a blast. I got my wife to cook me 12 pounds of manwich, and I got four bags of Fritos, and a whole line of vanilla Pepsi, and then I was good to go. I didn't write a great novel, but it was really fun.
Didn't you write like 150 pages?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you put
on. That's in one day?
No, 72 hours. Although I kept taking breaks. I had a lot of Nightmare on Elm Streets, and I kept watching those over and over for some reason. It was supposed to help me. But yeah, I think the average length for that contest is about 100 pages. So I wanted to be sure I won, you know, but then I guess I shot myself in the foot or something. Is that a partial answer? Close?
Three.
Okay. Yes.
How many times has the story been like rejected in comparison to, like, you know?
Yeah. I would guess it'd be very charitable to say 1 out of 10 gets accepted, I think. I still get rejected all the time. I wish I would. I keep waiting to become callous to it, you know? It doesn't happen. Somebody rejects me, and I mean, sure, I can mail it somewhere else, but at the same time, I'm putting them up in a little list of people I hate now. Other questions? Yes?
Is there a reason you chose not to write poetry?
I don't think in lines. I love to read poetry. I wanted to experience poetry to engage it, but I found that I don't think in lines. I do think in really dense images sometimes, but I don't think that's poetry. Poetry comes in a visual cadence or something that I don't have anyways. I wish I did. Then I'd be writing Motley Crue lyrics, you know, because I need them right now. Somebody else in there? Yes. Oh, did I read a lot of first person tonight, I guess? I try not to, actually, because first person for me is just way too easy. It just, bam, just runs away, you know? A third person for me takes a lot more craft, a lot more attention. I'm sorry about it, hitching with a lot of first person. Lately I've been writing a lot of second person, actually. I just wrote a cyberpunk wormhole story with the second person. I think it's pretty cool. I didn't read it tonight because I cannot think of a title for it that is decent. And also because it's a cyberpunk werewolf story, but I don't know if people have a taste for that. Anything else? More questions? Is that it? All right, well, thank you. I'm very happy for your questions.